My case is 99-468, State of Ohio versus James Arnett. Sister Springman.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Ron Springman from Hamilton County, here to represent the appellant of the State of Ohio. With permission of the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for my colleague, Mr. Bill Cummings.
You watch your time on the clock.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our position in this case is that Judge Marsh, in sentencing Arnett, did exactly as the law requires. She considered each of the relevant sentencing factors of 29-29-12, ultimately deciding that the age of the victim was the determining factor in the sentence. The reference to the Bible was used only to illustrate that is her choice, that the age of the victim.
But she went a little farther than that when she said, I finally answered my question late at night when I turned to one additional source to help me. And it appears by that statement that she was going outside the bounds of the statutory mitigating factors that she shouldn't have been considering.
That statement, the isolated sure does, Judge, but she gave due consideration to every one of the statutory elements. Here, one of the basic themes in her argument was age and her deliberative process, and it spread over 6 pages of the record. And the beginning, I think it's interesting to note that she looked at the age of Arnett himself and how he because she had pictures of him growing up as a child. Then she goes and gives due consideration to all the letters that were received on his behalf. Then she turns to the victim, again, to the age of the victim, to her innocence, to her lost innocence that occurred over the period of abuse for 5 years. Then she even makes a comment, and I believe it's at 51 of the record, as she's considering all these factors, right in the middle, she says, and basically, Mr. Arnett, you robbed that child of that whole sense of growing up and who she is. Her entire deliberative process, taken in context, is focused on the age of the victim, which is a proper statutory factor for the judge to consider in the imposition sentence. And when taken together in context, the age of the victim, that's a determining factor, not the biblical quote. Now, Judge, the biblical quote were not part of the sentencing criteria and it was something else, then we may have a different result in this matter. But Matthew 18, verses 5 to 6, any commentary, interpretation, or version that I consulted in preparation for this argument always talks about that phrase referencing the vulnerability of children.
But doesn't it really appear that she used the Bible as sort of a tie-break to relieve her suspicions of what the sentence should be, that she was kind of tied up on what to do, and then she's used the Bible then to determine once and for all what she would do. Doesn't it appear that way?
Not at all, Your Honor. I think the tiebreaker is the age of the victim. The Bible, the biblical reference to Scripture, is Scripture about the vulnerability of children. And children were recognized to be vulnerable 2,000 years ago, and they're recognized in the Ohio Revised Code as being vulnerable. That, you know, when you look at our code and how it's set up, we protect children. And under the rape statutes, children who are under 13 lack the capacity to consent because we protect children, the vulnerability of children. In the Eskridge line of cases, we make it easier to prove the force element of rape between an adult and a young child.
But counsel, one of the interesting aspects of this case is that it's not what it seems it might be. It's not a challenge under the First Amendment, under the Establishment Clause.
Right.
Instead, it is a due process claim.
The
due process was violated by virtue of the judge going, the argument is the judge having gone outside the statutorily set forth factors that this defendant's due process rights. So that's important probably from the start, that we know that we're not talking about the injection of religion into a governmental function. That's
exactly.
Not at hand. Okay.
This is a due process analysis. It's a question of law from our perspective. We welcome that analysis because we think Judge Marsh tracked the statute and did exactly what the law requires.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now with the new sentencing criteria, the judges have to put their reasons and articulate their justifications for a sentence on the record. She did exactly that, taking into consideration a number of factors, both militating for a harsher sentence and against a harsher sentence.
Is a list of criteria that the trial judge has to look at for sentencing an exclusive list?
I don't think it's an exclusive list, Judge. I think there's some wording in the statute that allows for other relevant factors that are consistent with the principles and purposes of the sentence.
So that it's not mutually exclusive to any other consideration that might come to a judge's attention.
Right.
Had there not been the quotation from the Bible in this case, and the judge had given the same sentence that she gave here, is that within the statutory guidelines?
Well, very easily, Judge, if my math is correct, the minimum sentence that should have been imposed here is 30 1/2 years. The maximum sentence is 101 1/2 years. So she's on the lower end of the range. And again, I think that shows that she harbors no animosity, bias, or prejudice against the defendant, and that it shows that biblical reference really tracked the statute, and she was concerned about the vulnerability of the young victim, and that was the hybrid. That this child was young, and she looked at the age of the child, and the innocence that was lost at the hands of this defendant, and thus was a determining factor in giving Arnett a 51-year sentence.
You mentioned point 12, I think, in answer to Justice Butler's question. Is that which says, in addition, the trial court may consider any other factors that are relevant to achieving this purpose of the principle of sentencing? Is that how her reference to Matthew comes in? Is that how she committed to refer to a biblical passage?
I think she's permitted to refer to it. Again, we say under the B1 factor. Because she needs to consider the age of the victim. But I think amicus argues in this case that it can come in as also another relevant factor in the sentencing process. But again, I don't want to stray too far from the main point, as I think Judge Marsh tracked the statute here.
That's what I was going to ask. If prior to the reference to the Bible, has she gone through all the statutory factors?
Yes.
And announcing why she wasn't in. Is that how it proceeded? And then she said.
Yes, Your Honor.
A bolstering of this verse from the Bible was a bolstering of her decision?
I think it was a bolstering, not of her decision, but a bolstering of the fact that age of the victim is what she was relying on. She did consider lots of things. She begins by looking at the background of the defendant's life and him as a kid. Then she goes on to talk about the letters that she received and the nature and circumstances of the event. And one interesting point, she does talk about the doctor, Dr. Baskin, who testified in mitigation on behalf of the defendant. And what's interesting there, the defendant was abused himself as a child. She makes this note that if your father, who abused him, were standing before me today, I would be looking at how I could protect you. But you violated this girl, you know, which implicit in that is now my account to do something to protect this little girl. And then she gave the biblical reference to maybe enhance her use of age as a statutory factor and then laying down the sentence.
This case is interesting because especially the amicus brief talks about the whole concept of judges' decision making, the process, and speaks to judges bring to their task their life experiences, their background, their education, and if a judge uses one of their many life experiences, in this case religious training or background or study, just like their other education or their family, you know, how is that distinct if it's used in the weighing? That's an interesting approach that's put forth by the amicus. in this case.
Right. I agree, Judge. I know that it would be impossible for judges to their upbringing values, you know, that they have to bring that with them to the decision-making process.
Yeah.
But it can go beyond the bounds of due process. If there were, for example, a religious reference that harbored some animosity towards the defendant.
As in Baker.
Baker, obviously, deeply distinguishable because Baker himself. I guess the judge thought Baker was referring to him as a step. And we have to look at Baker himself, who was a popular televangelist, and Arnett is not. So the appearance of that religiosity that was injected into that proceeding was a concern to the Baker court. And I don't think it needs to be a concern to this court because Arnett is not simply situated as Mr. Baker. This is not that type of case.
Does Baker or any statutory or ethical consideration require judges to check their fundamental beliefs at the door?
I don't believe so, Judge. I do not. Not at all. I'm aware of it. You know, again, I think that there's no controlling legal authority here to this court, but there is certainly some cases that provide guidance and instruction. I think the state of Hover, the case of Hover State, particularly applicable because that court sort of made the same ruling that we're asking this court to make, is that even though the judge made a biblical reference, the judge did consider all other relevant sentencing criteria, and that played a large role in the Hove court deciding to uphold the sentence of the trial.
Probably many judges, even but they don't mention that. In this case, the judge was straightforward and she mentioned what she was thinking about when she was passing judgment.
Right. And as long as it tracked the statute and the biblical reference track the statute, I would submit that that's permissible. But I also, there could be that appearance that the judge doesn't track the statute and pulls out other different religious references that could pose a due process problem. And that's it. But certainly not here. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Mr. Bartlett.
Interestingly enough, though, the statute, too, says one of the factors to be considered is the age of the victim.
That's correct.
And so that's, interestingly, that this biblical reference tracks with the law.
Well, certainly the law, it reflects the morals of our society.
Sure.
The fact that in our Western culture, we consider it important to protect children.
Right.
They're entitled to wear it.
But I mean, we know that that's the point. The law typically will track, it should track with the community norms.
But the point is that it was not the age of the child that was the factor that decided it was
the age of the child as considered by her religion, in other words, an affront to children in her religion.
I know. But the due process, the argument here is that the due process rights of the defendant were violated, and based on I think the only precedent we really have is the Baker case, and in the Baker case it was that the judge wasn't expressing a method of weighing the evidence. The judge expressed, at least the court found, that the judge there expressed a personal animus.
And same here, the judge expressed a personal animus.
Oh.
He said, my religion tells me what you did is this most heinous crime that you would
But it didn't. But yet she didn't give a heinous sentence.
She gave basically a life sentence.
But it's a middle range sentence, isn't it? I mean,
whether she had added on another 10 years would be probably.
It's certainly harsh, yeah, yet the crime permitted a harsher one.
But whether she had added on another 10 or 20 years, I do not consider this a lenient sentence. He is basically.
But I mean, it wouldn't. His due process rights wouldn't be violated by virtue of the fact that it was a harsh, at least middle to harsh sentence rather than a lenient one.
Had she not stated in candor her deciding factor, I would have objected to the sentence.
But it's in the weighing, isn't it, counsel?
It's in the weighing.
She does the weighing, and she also thinks, well, this is what I learned in law school, and this is what I learned as a kid, and these are my values. This is different than those other factors which you wouldn't complain would violate due process. That she said, gee, you know, these sort of things seem bad to me.
This is different. She is not bringing with her her moral background from which she perceives justice in this case. What she is saying is, up until this point, she weighed the factors, and in her mind, she could not reach a decision as to a lesser sentence or a more harsh sentence. Now, obviously, in her mind, this was a harsh sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It was greater than what she had given an unrepentant murderer. And she quoted a quote from her Bible that said that this is a heinous crime and you deserve a harsh sentence. So whether we think it's a harsh sentence or not, she obviously, in her mind, found this to be a harsh sentence and that he was deserving of it. Up until that point, she was weighing the considerations of the psychological that this gentleman within 5 to 8 years could be treated within the system, and that he could be released after some shorter period of time and would follow up treatment according to the psychologist. Yes.
When you're committing murder, you get one sentence.
Factor became impermissible in addition because it was that if the judge considers, the court considers its own religious beliefs, it's identical to consider the religion of the defendant.
In your view, is it permissible for a judge to pray before issuing a sentence for guidance as to the right to live in the sentence?
As long as it's not, there was a distinction made, I believe, with regard to the Marsh decision, where prayer was held before a legislative body.
No, I'm talking about this privately. In your own home, the
right? Privately, I think that would be permissible. But if you...
Would it not be better if the amicus points out to lay that out for all to understand than to do it secretly?
No, because, if she had laid out for all to understand that she has prayed to make a just decision, simply stating that, I think it would be less of a problem than laying out for all to understand that I'm giving you a hard sentence because my Bible told me to.
Would your view be different if she had laid out all of the factors that she was taking into consideration, announced her sentence, and then just referred to the Bible afterwards? Would that make a difference?
Only to the extent that if she referred to the Bible saying, may God have mercy on your soul, or something to that effect, something general. But if she afterwards, after making a sentence, saying, oh, by the way, I made this sentence because my Bible
then
said...
Then it would be the same case that we have here, but if she just quoted from the Bible afterwards, would that make sense?
Well, if she quoted this quote, I would find that.
You would still find that objection.
Because then it would be implied that she had used that quote to make her decision.
Supposing that the atheist, Marilyn Madeline O'Hare's position was that it's our job to forgive and forget those who have transgressed in this manner, and had written that. And the judge had read that from O'Hare and said, therefore, I'm putting this defendant on probation. Prosecutor have a right to appeal that then? They can appeal a sentence now.
Or by failing to follow the factors, I think, yes, that would be a...
So you would have us, based on that, based on the prosecutor, assuming they have the right to appeal and they can now ask for review of sentence. The probation was not the right sentence, and he should have been given a life sentence because the judge based it on what Marilyn Madeline O'Hare said.
If that was her...
Additional criteria,
and well,
it's harder, doesn't it?
My problem is it's a rather generalized statement, forgive and forget, because mitigation itself is saying, do we find mitigating factors for which to forgive this person and give mercy to this person for their crime? But if it's stated as an absolute dogma, I believe we should forgive and forget. And I quote this from Madeline O'Hare, or from the Bible, for that matter, that we should forgive and forget, therefore I'm giving you probation. I think, yes, the state of Ohio could jump up and feel that very definitely, because that's not the intent of the statute.
Counsel, okay, if I understand, first, what you complain about is not just the consultation with the Bible, it is what you believe that was a determining factor, the determining factor, and the
or a determining factor. Either one.
If this, so you agree, I believe you agree that this judge consulted the appropriate factors, weighed the appropriate factors, and but for this statement could have arrived at this sentence, and your client would have no legal complaint for the sentence imposed, but
requisite for the matters demonstrated she thought about them. So basically, our point is that she's indicated to her own words that had it not been for this belief, she would have given a more lenient sentence. And let's lay this in perspective. As you go through the same process, not making a statement, but after she finished in the next sentence, said, by the way, she's not settled, your horoscope says this wasn't going to be your lucky day. That the same kind of thing?
Yes.
She's expressing that she believes in astrology and that our lives are controlled by the stars. She consulted her star maps that day.
Even though she throws it in as an aside after she's all done.
Well, it's the same as if a jury had made a decision and then the judge allowed you to interview the jury after they've made the decision. And in candor, our juror says, yes, that we consulted some external evidence. Still, even though it happened after the fact,
let's throw in one more likelihood, and that is that the judge, somewhere in the sentencing process, is just very candid and saying, I just can't stomach people who engage in this kind of conduct. So I see that my children just up here with me, and Mr. I followed the statute, but I got to tell you, I'm just sick of your guy. I'm not judges. Give a free lecture in addition to the sentence. Is that the basis for overturning this?
If it would imply an unauthorized actor, such as making an example of that particular defense, in other words, the judge has been lenient to all child abusers up to that point, but I just can't.
So the judge just has history. I mean, when you tell your client, we're going into, killer's courtroom, he consistently, she consistently, on child abusers, gives facts. Gives every inch of the law allowed. Is there any basis for appeal there?
Let me back up a little bit. If the judge is merely expressing her disgust of the crime, obviously the people state of Ohio and the legislatures have already expressed that disgust by having a severe sentence and will make that crime. If, on the other hand, she regularly gives masks for child abusers without looking at mitigating factors, yet that would be a violation of the statute. If you could show them through a post-sentencing hearing that in every other case she gave masks, no matter what mitigating factors were,
Judge Marsh did, in fact, list all of the factors. She's considered whether it's deduced on behalf of the defendant, the doctor's testimony explaining the defendant's condition, the nature of the sexually oriented offense, the age of the little girl, defendant's use of child pornography, the horrible and traumatic psychological damage that the abuse has caused and will continue to cause throughout the little girl's life. Those are all the factors that she took into consideration. And a sentence just midway 50 years certainly is not a line. And then,
maybe not up. Yes. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. And then she just, as I said before, bolstered her consideration of all those factors by a reference to the Bible. What is the prejudice?
It may not be out of line with the average sentence given across the state of Ohio by judges facing the same situation, but she has already told you as she considers her sentence to be a harsh sentence by comparison. And she gives a comparison. She says, I, an unrepentant murderer, only got 20 years. So, and then she quotes the Bible saying that
that's
this
not
deserves a harsh sentence.
Right.
So she's telling you that this is a harsh sentence for her. So even though it might be middle of the road for some other judge, in her courtroom, this was a harsh sentence, and she's that source. And it was that source that told her to give a harsh sentence.
I've your red light now, but I do have a question that I think hopefully you can answer it really quickly, because I think maybe at least answered it partially. If she had, I was very impressed with the amicus brief, I have to say. It was more persuasive. And I guess I wonder if the trial judge here had said, had everything she said except Matthew, but she referred to a statement that was made by a member of the family who had testified, and she found that statement to be the one that just made it for her. And it wasn't a particularly fundamental, basic kind of observation of law or sentencing, but it was just a statement that attracted her. And she used that and said, "Well, now I'm going to give her a sentence." Would that be offensive to you?
Well, it depends on the sentence. Now, the statement was the same sentence. The statement was to the effect where the relative or whoever was saying that this child was happy, innocent child before this occurred, and now she's, going for psychological therapy and treatment and so forth, as was testified in here. That would be a permissible, but if the statement was, I consider the statement of the mother that when she quoted the Bible, her religious beliefs with regard to how horrible this crime was, it would have the same effect as the judge considering her own religious beliefs in the first instance.
What if the judge cited to a passage from the Quran? The judge is Christian, but she reads the Quran, and she finds a statement in the Quran that she thinks is similar to this, and she uses that. Is that a problem? Does it have to be her religion? Or is it just something from which she receives inspiration? I mean, we have to admit that much of our law in this country is based on Judeo-Christian, Islam fundamental beliefs, and so I think I think if she has stated,
I received inspiration from this quotation, and it confirms the reflection of society's belief that we must protect the young. In those general terms, that would not be a problem. But if she's quoted the Quran as if she held it as her own religious persuasion or belief, then we'd be right back where we are, because she would be dictating her religious beliefs from the bench. One of the problems that was raised in one of the cases that I reviewed was that if judges are allowed to make sentences upon their religious beliefs, then how do you appeal that? Do you appeal it by quoting other parts of the Bible and saying, well, yeah, the judge didn't consider forgive and forget it. This turned the other cheek, and some other portion of the Bible that should have been applied also. We open up a can of worms here where the court becomes entangled in promoting religion as opposed to deciding cases based upon the law. And I think that's and that's why you'll never probably see a quotation like this from an appellate court, where an appellate court would say, we affirm the decision of the trial court and we'll quote from the Bible and give this quote the Bible as being justification for the harshness of the sentence. But if the appellate courts can't do it, why should the trial court?
That's easier to do.
Thank you, Mr. President. Cummings, trying to save a little over 3 minutes for you for rebuttal.
Thank you,
Mr. Cummings. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. The judge quotes that from her Bible and then says, I'm not in the retribution business, probation. Do you object to that?
Well, the sentence seemingly was unconnected to the pronouncement, so I don't think there would be any basis for
her. Well, it would be connected with it, because she doesn't think she's in the retribution business, because vengeance is for the Lord to enact, not we mortals.
Well, I don't think I would have a problem with that. I think these cases, just by their nature, have to be very fact-sensitive as to exactly what's quoted and how it's interpreted in the context of the case. And I think in this particular case, I think there's no due process violation simply because the quoted passage dovetails beautifully with the permissive factor of the revised code. Had different Bible verses been quoted that indicated that it took the judge into a different sentencing area or different field of consideration, I think there would be a due process problem here. I think this is a case where that's luckily not a problem because it dovetails beautifully with factor B1. And I think that's the key analysis here. If the reference is to something that is covered and is a permissible factor, I don't think there's any due process problem whatsoever. If it goes in a different direction, I think there arguably certainly could be.
What is your response to Mr. Bartlett's suggestion that it's pretty difficult to appeal from a sentence where the judge quotes one Bible verse?
It's difficult to appeal.
How do you feel that?
Well, I think that the appeal proceed, you know, would be a determination as to whether or not that particular Bible verse is problematic or not in the context of that case. If the verse quoted goes right back to the principal factor and it's within the appropriate context, I don't think it's a problem. It just becomes part of the background of the judge, part of her concept of moral knowledge that she brings to the deliberative process. And I don't think that is something the judge should be expected to check at the door when they take a bench.
You're properly defending it. You're not espousing it, are you?
I'm defending it certainly in this case.
Right. I understand that. That's your job. But are you espousing it?
This would have been certainly better left unsaid.
Okay.
That goes without saying. But at the same time, I don't think we punish the judge for her candor.
Well, but the amicus brief says it's better if the judge thinks it's better that the judge said it.
Yeah.
What do you? Is that better? Or I take it you don't agree with that.
I think it's better in the sense that I think the citizens of the state and the country have a better understanding of law, their judges' basic decisions, where they come from. In that sense, it certainly is good. And I think that we certainly don't want to encourage judges to falsely mask their faith in the deliberative process. What I meant to say was, in a legal context, certainly this would have been, we wouldn't have been here over the past 3 months had she not said it. I don't even want to clarify that. But
counsel, if she had not gone through the different factors on each of the statutes, and it just simply said that she was difficult case and struggled with it, I suppose the violence that happened there from the 50 years. Would that be a different case? Would that be a civil issue then?
I think it would be a stronger case of disruption, yes. I think what makes this case much easier is that Judge Barr seems to track the statute and did exactly what she's supposed to do. If the reading of the transcript indicated that she went through none of those considerations and went straight to the Bible, I do think that would be a possibly something to argue. Although then again, it seems that in her situation, I see my time's up and I will finish that question if she guesses. I think that in this case, since the fact that she did seem to consider the term it is a permissible factor, even that would certainly be supported. But I think that would be a much more difficult case for the same thing.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.